Our host needs no introduction.
His name is...
A name so simple it rolls right off your tongue.
His name is James... No, his name is... James Lawrence! Lawrence! Lawrence!
Try again.
Forrest Lone... Lars! Lars!
No! Chuck Jaffe.
Yes! 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 We're like this!
I'll say it again so you remember, okay? This is Money Life with Chuck Jaffe.
Wow! 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 All I can say is wow!
Please do not overdramatize these proceedings.
And now, here's Chuck.
He's one in a million.
He sure is.
Good morning and welcome to Money Life. Money Life for April the 28th. Thanks for joining me. And in something that it may not really affect you a lot, it affects me a lot, and I think it makes for me the show a little bit more fun. We think we have resolved our audio issues, and that should mean we have our sounders back. Yep, sounds and noises and half sentences and nonsense sounds. Yeah. We've got them all back. We're not going to use them that much. We're going to use them sparingly. We're going to reintroduce them slowly back into the show. We're going to get some new things that we want to get, do some other things to make this work a little bit better. But I say it because one of you guys actually recognized part of the problem that we seem to have going with our the audio computer that we use before we did. A number of you made notes to me after we said, hey, we're going to be missing sounders for a while, who said, I won't miss them, not because you didn't like them necessarily, but because when they would come on, they'd sort of blow your ears off. They were out of modulation with the rest of everything else. So rather than being at roughly the same pitch as me, it was as if suddenly they were being screamed at you. And you'd like to think we would recognize that, but there are reasons why we may not have, and some of you did first. So I want to make sure that if that is what you experience, and again, we're going to use them sparingly, but if that's what you experience, I want to know. I'd like to hear from you. Like, hey, Chuck, what happened to the sound quality? Now, look, there are times when we do stuff where we know our sound quality is not going to be great. You have a guest. We had one the other day who pretty much insisted on using a speakerphone. Okay, knock yourself out. It's not going to sound great. And it's a reflection of them more than it is a reflection of us. Okay, that's going to happen sometimes. There are other times when it might be unavoidable that we've got a sound issue because of the connection we've got, and we can't do things. Trust me, if you could see what a soundboard looks like, a million little knobs, each one can control something, but you can't always finesse it the right way. But there are other times when things can happen. And in my case, where I do a lot of the recording and whatever, it could be my stinking cat walking next to my soundboard and moving things. So anytime anything happens, if you dislike the sound quality, you dislike whatever, we'd like to hear about it because you do make the show better. So I promise not to overuse the sounders. I don't think we'll go to that extreme, but I'm happy to have them back. I hope we can keep them back. I hope we can add to it and just have a little more fun with stuff because I love being able to do it. And I know that the guys at the Financial Food Fight will be excited because they connect with me through the system so I can actually play my sounders while I'm talking to them. And I'm not going to tell them. I'm just going to bring them back and drop them on them. So there you have it. Today, I've got great stuff to drop on you in terms of our guests. It starts with Tom Lydon. He's here for the ETF of the week. After which, our big interview is with Brian Singer, who is the head of dynamic allocation strategies for William Blair and the William Blair funds. He is not going to be all that happy a guy. I read a blog post. William Blair started a blog, and I read his blog post, his first one, and I thought, I want to talk to him because he believes in a downside and a dark event that I don't necessarily see the same outcomes that he sees, but I've seen the potential for it for a while. So I wanted to ask him about it. I know he is not very happy with the market. So you'll get that sense. I still think it's valuable to learn from that. Then Matthias Kuhlme and the gang from Hightower Global Investment Solutions in for collective wisdom. Normally they go on Wednesdays. This week, due to a conflict, they had to go on Thursdays. Bob Powell's not going to be here this week, but Matthias and his friends, Jimmy Hausberg, Roger Schaefer, will be here. We'll have some fun with them. And then it's the Money Life Market Call with Peter Jacobs from Jacobs Brohl Asset Management. He's a value contrarian. That's what he likes to say his style is. So that's our show. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. You'll find my work online at MarketWatch.com. I had a column that went up yesterday. Should have another one up today, by the way. You can also follow us on Twitter at Money Life Show, at MKTW Jaffe. Our website has our show archives. It has our recent and upcoming guest page and a whole lot more. That, of course, is MoneyLifeShow.com. Money Life is independent personal finance talk. It's not just what I like or believe in. It's not just, oh, we're going to make you feel good. And it's not designed to sell you anything. It really isn't. This is not some place where you go, oh, well, we're sitting here humping your leg trying to get you to buy our services. Nope, you can't hire me as your financial advisor. This is straight talk on pocketbook and portfolio issues and investing concerns and much, much more. And you're going to hear stuff like Brian Singer today, where you may not be happy because you may not like what he's got to say because he's not Pollyanna. He does think there's bear stuff coming. But it's important for you to recognize that that sentiment is out there and maybe there's some truth behind it. So you want to determine how you feel about it and go from there. We'd love to have you get in touch with us, chuck@moneylifeshow.com to reach me. But don't be shy reaching out, direct messaging us on Twitter, or any of those other sorts of things. So that's it. It's Money Life for April the 28th. Thanks so much for joining us. Again, our lineup, Tom Lydon, Brian Singer, the Hightower Gang, and then Peter Jacobs. We'll start things off with the ETF of the week when Money Life rolls on right after this message.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
Tom Lydon joins us now with the ETF of the week. Tom, of course, is the editor at ETF Trends. He joins us each week at this time. And if you want more information, well, that's easy enough. You go to ETFTrends.com. They're on Twitter, at ETFTrends. Tom is on Twitter. He's at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks, Chuck. Great to be back.
Our ETF of the week is
the Healthcare Select Sector Spider Fund, ticker symbol XLV.
The XLV, the Healthcare Select Sector Spider Fund. Now, last week we were talking about energy, and energy had been sort of the headline. Everything with oil prices, energy had been crushed. But while everybody had been focused on energy, healthcare hadn't been much better. So is this same kind of story as last week with a different chorus in terms of we're talking about healthcare being ready for a bounce back as opposed to energy, or is there something else afoot here?
I think you're right, Chuck. First and foremost, when we talk about trends, this ETF, for the first time in a while, is above its 200-day average, just slightly. So when you look at the fundamentals of healthcare, it really has been impacted by what's going on in biotech. We know that biotech stocks earlier this year just got crushed, almost to the point where they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater because they had such a huge run-up in the last 3 years. With that being said, healthcare in general and some of the big pharmaceutical companies, healthcare providers, suppliers, they collectively make up a part of this index. Names like Johnson & Johnson or Pfizer, Merck, United Health, Amgen, big pillars within the healthcare industry, they have bounced back recently as well, and I think that's been encouraging. So, a little bit like we talked about last week, healthcare is a component of the S&P 500. If you're a long-term investor and you're well-diversified among ETFs and mutual funds, you probably have healthcare in your portfolio, and you're happy that it's bounced back, although still healthcare has underperformed the S&P so far year to date. But with that being said, if you do have cash available, or you are opportunistic, or if you tend to be a tactical trader on top of owning positions for the long term, this is one of those sectors that you might want to consider. Because if it just goes above its 200-day average and for the last year or so it's been in decline, maybe this is the beginning of a new uptrend. As long as you're disciplined, you watch it very closely. And if you do buy it with the idea that you're going to sell it when it goes below, you have to have some type of discipline in place to keep an eye on it at least a couple times a week to be sure that you don't buy it at a recent high.
In terms of what investors should be looking at here, you know, we talked a little bit last week about how you're either dedicated and you ride things out, and that's what we would have seen in energy, but it's also what we would see in healthcare. So is this one of those cases where, hey, this is good news if you're the person who's been on the downside of things and you don't need to deploy new assets to it? Or is this one of those cases where you want to be opportunistic? And even if you've been a long-term investor, going a little opportunistic is okay.
I think when you look in general at the average investor, what's happened since March of 2009 when the markets really had a nice run, a couple things. Investors have been more responsible about the performance in their portfolio because technology has allowed them to do that, which is fantastic. They've also been a little bit more picky about the mutual funds that they're selecting. If their mutual funds are not outperforming or at least keeping pace with their benchmarks, if they're charging expenses that are too high, and they're kicking off capital gains even in years when they're down, investors are starting to open up their eyes more and start to shift to ETFs. And even broad-based ETFs that cover most major sectors have been fantastic. Here we are, fast forward to where we are today. I think most feel, based on the changing global economics, rising interest rate environment, albeit a little slower than most people thought, that picking your areas or picking sectors or picking industry groups is going to be that much more important. So if you have a long-term investment outlook in a diversified portfolio, great. But maybe take a portion and put it into areas that maybe might just start showing new trends as they develop. Challenge yourself as an investor to get more involved. Not saying day trading, but long-term trends like a 200-day average doesn't require that you're in and out every week. But if you had a trade a month and you were trading, you know, three or four sectors that might have been beaten up, like we talked about oil last week, maybe like emerging markets that maybe for the first time in many years might be coming back, these are those types of investments that can really make a difference in your portfolio as long as you stick to that discipline.
Obviously, you're looking at a trend following discipline. So there's no headline that could come in that would make you say, oh, this would be terrible. Because if the headline comes in and it drives the industry lower, the 200-day moving average winds up trading you out. But I'm just curious. You know, you talked about all of the pluses here. Do you have a significant amount of political risk in this one just because, well, we've got Obamacare, but come November, we're going to be looking at a lame duck Obama. And who the heck knows who's going to be holding court at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So do you worry at all that as much as all the trends look right, the politics could come into play?
It sure could. I mean, any day something could happen which can affect any sector. But to the other point, there are 77 million baby boomers that need greater treatment and will continue to need greater treatment. So healthcare is not going away. It might be a little bit more volatile as we go to the fall for sure. But the progress that we're seeing in healthcare, in pharmaceuticals, in biotechnology is huge and it continues to increase, which just begs for more profitability. So are we going to see less volatility? No. But as you point out, headline risk does affect the stock price, and the stock price or the ETF price in this case will affect the long-term trend. So all you need to do is remove the emotional aspect, remove the news aspect, just stick to that simple 200-day average. It should take care of things over time.
It's the healthcare select sector spider, the XLV, the ETF of the week from Tom Lydon. Tom, thanks as always.
Thanks, Chuck.
Tom Lydon is the editor at ETFTrends.com. If you want to check out the website and you still want more information, then follow them on Twitter at ETFTrends. And while you're at it, follow Tom. He's at Tom Lydon. That is a great way to start our Thursday show. And a great way to follow up is the big interview. We're going to get to that when Money Life continues right after this message.
At Hightower, providing the best fiduciary advice to every advisory client is not just a job. It's a legal duty. Sophisticated asset management, lifetime financial planning and wealth management solutions. At Hightower, it all adds up to peace of mind. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Let's face it, size matters.
Truly epic proportions.
Especially when it comes to your financial talk.
I have a plan.
Quick sound bites and rush chatter won't help you.
Blah, 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 blah.
You want more details, more depth.
Concentrate, focus power.
More to think about.
What do you think?
This is Money Life's Big Interview.
I think it's brilliant.
A meaningful conversation on money and markets.
This is why we're here.
So settle in.
I made you coffee.
You're going to be here a while.
That's just perfect.
Welcome to the big interview here on Money Life, and I'm joined right now by Brian Singer. He is head of the William Blair Dynamic Allocation Strategies team, and he's co-portfolio manager of the William Blair Macro Allocation Fund. If you want to hear more about the funds, or you want to learn more about the funds, go to williamblairfunds.com. But what I'd really recommend you do is go to blog.williamblairfunds.com, because they are blogging at this point, and Brian, among others, has put up some really interesting blog posts. We also have a link direct to one of Brian's blog posts at the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page. And if you want alerts as to when they're blogging and more, then you're going to follow William Blair on Twitter, where they are at William Blair Co. Brian Singer, welcome to Money Life.
Hi, Chuck. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and I appreciate you being here. You know, one of the things that I found really interesting is that when you guys launched the blog, the first thing that you were talking about was what you called a liquidity-oriented panic. Now, the reason I found this interesting is completely personal, which is that for several years, well, for decades now, I start every year doing my forecast of what's to come in the year ahead in the fund industry and what events we might see that I expect to be writing about. And I went through a stretch where the one thing I got wrong for like 4 years in a row was I kept saying, we're going to have a liquidity-oriented panic. And so I gave up. I said, I won't forecast it again because it's my main reason for being wrong, because it is so hard to find. And then I read your blog post and I was like, that's a pretty good case for it. And oh, by the way, I've been nervous about it for a while. So explain to my audience what it is that you're looking for and what liquidity-oriented panic is going to feel like, taste like, smell like if it happens.
It's not going to feel or taste very good, I'll tell you that. The real, I think, issue that is in place now, and the case I would make, is that there a lot of the world changed in 2008. And there are two aspects of that change that are important in terms of a potential liquidity-driven panic. The first is it led to a behavioral change in the way that all investors seem to be investing. And I mean institutional investors, defined benefit plans, individuals, it doesn't matter. And the reason is that in 2008, the world changed in terms of expectations. The world was looking at liabilities. Defined benefit plans had liabilities. They had assets to meet those liabilities. Individuals were all planning to retire in Florida. They had houses in Florida, or they had grand visions of houses in Florida. And then suddenly, in a matter of just a few months, that all evaporated. And the commitments that they had made, whether mentally or actually financially, were quite significant. Now we observe behaviors of market participants that are reflective of that event. And what it means is investors look at the world and they say to themselves, and again, institutional or retail, they say to themselves,
Well, we can't afford to have another event like 2008. We can't afford to have downside like that because we're already underwater relative to our liabilities and relative to our expectations. Similarly, we can't afford to miss any type of market rally because we really need to get back what we lost over that period of time. The reason that's important from a behavioral perspective is it causes investors to be pro-cyclical. In other words, as markets begin to decline, they begin to say to themselves, we can't take this, and we have to exit the market. Or if the market begins to rally, they say to themselves, we can't miss this. We need to buy into this. That's momentum trading that's going on there. And you begin to see investors moving together and creating short-term volatility as they do that, as they act in a very pro-cyclical manner. So that's the first element. It's a behavioral shift in, among investors that didn't really exist prior to 2008. The second thing is layered upon that are significant regulatory changes in the industry that also came out of 2008 and even prior to that. These regulations have removed from the marketplace the standard microstructure or trading structures that all investors are used to. Usually what happens is when there is a panic, and I'll go straight to panic, when there is a shock in the investment community and investors are trying to get out of something or get into some investment, the dealers could expand and contract their balance sheet to absorb that panic and literally take advantage of it from a profitability perspective. They were paid to step in and provide liquidity. They are not allowed to do that anymore after Dodd-Frank. That ability to expand their balance sheet and contract their balance sheet to absorb that liquidity need in the marketplace is now gone. We don't know where it's going to come from in the future or how it's going to materialize in the future in the time frame that is often needed. Who has the money at this point who can actually provide the liquidity? Well, the asset owners and advisors like us. But we're long-term investors. We don't jump in there in a very short horizon to try to provide liquidity. We can't expand and contract our balance sheets. We just have the assets that our clients have provided us to advise, or they have the assets that they actually own. And that's it. So we don't know how the market's going to function. We do know that the dealers have pulled away from the bond market. We do know that the dealers have pulled in their role, have pulled back in the equity market, and the clearing function is done differently. You bring those two together, what you have is an environment for short-term heightened volatility and liquidity panics that could be very, very extreme if we see any significant event like a 2008 or like the Asian crisis in 98. Any number of prior significant bear market events could be quite exacerbated in the short term. That's kind of what we're looking at.
Okay. I've got a question that kind of follows up, because on the one hand, you talk about an event akin to 2008, which is cataclysmic. And on the other, you at points in your answer were mentioning specific industries. You talked about energy, for example, or you talked about specific countries like China. So is it possible to have a liquidity-driven panic that affects an industry rather than the whole market? So in other words, you really feel it in the energy space, for example, or you really feel it in China, and it maybe brings everything down a little bit, but it doesn't get to the level of 2008.
That's a really good question, Chuck, and I think you can have it either, that's probably a better statement, narrowly defined in terms of a sector or a country, or even more broadly defined on a global basis. And I'll speak very briefly to both of those. On a narrow basis, what we find is that, let's say the industry decides it needs to, for whatever reason, or wants to exit the energy sector. In the current environment, a lot of what happens is the flow that actually occurs in the marketplace gets shifted off to algorithmic or high-frequency traders, and they turn over that equity very quickly, and they also hedge it. And they hedge it using things like crude oil, energy product, to actually manage their balance sheets when they're doing that. And it can create an environment where the panic can actually be very narrowly defined in a single sector. That can actually occur as the marketplace is trying to find who can actually provide liquidity in that sector. We saw similarly at a country level a panic in the China A shares last year, last August. A very small event was China devaluing its currency by a whoppingly monstrous 2.5%, which is meaningless in the scheme of things. But that sparked a panic in the China A shares, the locally traded China equity market, that was absolutely astounding. So you can get very, very narrow instances of this because there aren't the type of players who can immediately step in, expand their balance sheets, and provide the liquidity. The market has to seek out who has the liquidity, who is a longer-term investor, and is actually willing and able to make the decision, which takes a little longer, to provide that liquidity to the marketplace, because that's not their primary function. That is a secondary or tertiary function for those players.
Okay.
That's the narrow element of it.
Okay.
The broader global element is also important.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, so I hate to kind of drop the big question ultimately, but as folks have listened to you and as I read your commentary, obviously you're bearish here. You're seeing something bad happening. Big and long and cataclysmic, or can we avoid the cataclysm and fine, we got to go through bear markets. They happen. This is one. It's coming. We'll get through it.
Great question. Easy answer. First, generally speaking, risky assets are actually attractive. On a fundamental basis, they are attractive. We want to own them. The problem that we have today is we run a significant risk that investors lose trust in the administrators that are, in effect, controlling the, at this point, the broader macroeconomic levers of the economy, central banks, treasury departments in terms of fiscal policy. If we lose trust in those players, that is the type of thing that is a significant risk to the marketplace. Plus, we have many unknowable unknowns associated with Chinese growth, terrorist events, different populist developments around the world with Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union. Spain can't even form a government right now because of populism. These are all the huge uncertainties that are hanging over the market, and I think the way to engage in the market at this point is what is known as a convex or nonlinear manner. The best way is to try to own the cheap assets but buy insurance through put options to protect yourself against downside tail risk.
Well, that sounds like it sets us up for another interview, which we're going to have to do because we're out of time here. But, Brian, this has been great. I hope we get a chance to chat again.
Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate it. I hope we do, too.
Brian Singer is the head of William Blair Dynamic Allocation Strategies Team, and he's co-portfolio manager of the William Blair Macro Allocation Fund. For more information, to read his blog post and more, go to blog.williamblairfunds.com. Linked up at the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page. Up next, collective wisdom from Hightower Global Investment Solutions when Money Life continues right after this message.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
When it comes to investing and managing money, there is no one right way.
Of course, people do go both ways.
Ultimately, you and your advisors will make shared decisions to determine the path you take.
It appears we share the same passions.
Welcome to Collective Wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions, where Hightower advisors look at key situations facing you and help you see how discussion and analysis can lead to ideal decisions. Yes, it's time to get smart and put our heads together. And make the best decision for your situation.
Welcome to Collective Wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions. This is the segment where we are joined by multiple guests, all representing Hightower Advisors or their piece of Hightower Advisors. That's because Hightower, it doesn't come in and work with an advisor and take over everything they do and say, this is how you're going to believe. This is what we think of as an organization. Instead, it works with experienced advisors and allows them to bring their knowledge and expertise to the group. Then they use that to play off and with each other to come to the decisions that say, hey, as an advisor, here's what I want to be able to tell my clients from all the resources that I have available. If you want to learn more about the Hightower difference, go to HightowerAdvisors.com. They're on Twitter at Hightower, A-D-V-S-O-R. Hightower is a sponsor of the show. Joining me right now is Matthias Kuhlme, Head of Global Investment Solutions at Hightower. He's on Twitter at MoneyClipBlog. Also, Roger Schaefer, Managing Director at Schaefer Wealth Management in Alpharetta, Georgia, and Jimmy Hausberg, Managing Director and Partner at the Hausberg Group in Los Angeles. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program. Our topic today is the jobs market and wage growth. Now, Matthias, one of the things you've talked about in the past is how Hightower does some interesting data analysis. Well, this is the data that everybody wants to know about. So as you guys at Hightower are parsing these numbers up, what are they telling us?
Well, Chuck, we like to explain it in how to think about the world in lines and graphs, right? It's basically using chart analysis. And there was one interesting thing that we continue to spot that is somewhat disturbing. Wage growth in the U.S. is not only lacking economic developments, but also the multi-year increase in equity values, and the latter in a very, very meaningful way, to the opposite, of course. So what it tells us is that the labor market and consequently the economy has still a lot of room to expand. And more importantly, you know, it's not peaking in the very traditional sense, as we would have to assume, and this is an important aspect when trying to understand the Fed's rate hike logic. So in fact, many Americans, in our view, have never fully recovered after the 2008 and 2009 fallout unless, and this is the important qualifier, one had assets to invest in or real estate. It's probably a topic for another time. Let's talk about one related item that is part of our graphs here. Inflation as the quintessential flip side of income. The common argument is that inflation is hardly an issue, right? The numbers continue to be rather low, at least by official readings. But as we have discussed also before, the real drivers impacting income are not captured by those readings. You know, think of the price of healthcare or education, just to name a few. Those run in double-digit territory and are truly inflationary, impacting the average consumer. So let me summarize. Without meaningful wage growth, there's no meaningful basis for me to assume that the labor market and the economy, consequently, has and will recover fully anytime soon, and related, that the Fed will embark on a more aggressive hiking path. I think we're already seeing the Fed backpedal from their recent decision. So in final conclusion, the lack of income creation, in my view, is one of the most severe socioeconomic challenges that we're facing in today's world, not only domestically.
Let's bring in Roger Schaefer to the discussion at this point. Roger, that's Matthias looking very big picture as he looks at the data. What do you see out of the data?
Thanks for having me back on, Chuck. Let me talk more about the job market and elaborate on the wage growth or lack thereof that Matthias just referenced, and also kind of bring in an additional new trend that we're seeing. During the global financial crisis and the Great Recession, the United States lost approximately 9 million jobs from 2008 to 2010. From 2010 through the first quarter of 2016, we have now gained back to about 14.5 million jobs. That's meaningful. The unemployment rate has gone from 10% in October 2009. We're now down to 5% in March 2016. The March payroll increase of 215,000 makes it now 66 consecutive months of positive job growth. And we're averaging about 225,000 a month for the last 12 months. What has been debated with a lot of this data is this real unemployment? And that's brought in this term labor force participation rate. And all that means is what percent of the population is actively employed or looking for work. And so this new trend that I referenced is we are now seeing the labor force grow. For the past 12 months, we've added 2 million increase into that labor force. It's the largest jump, Chuck, since 2007-2008. Therefore, economic growth is finally overcoming two big factors. One is the loss of workers due to the baby boomers retiring, and two are those that are on government assistance that are not currently working. Part of this reason for this real economic growth is faster wage growth. Matthias talked about it. He talked about that it's lagging. It has been, but we're finally starting to see a pickup, 2.3% the last 12 months. The first 3 months of this 2016 first quarter, we're seeing that annual rate jump to 2.7. So that coupled with low commodity oil and gas, holding down the inflation that Matthias also mentioned, that should lead to a strong U.S. consumer and wind at the U.S. consumer's back.
Interesting. Let's put it all together with Jimmy Hausberg right now. Jimmy, the Fed likes to say that they are data dependent. As investors, we're not. But you've just heard your partners talk about the data and the picture. If you had to tell your clients about the data and say, hey, this is how we might want to react, what would you be telling them to do right now? Does the data tell you to take a stronger step and become more aggressive, or does it tell you to be more defensive?
Well, thank you for having me, Chuck, as well. And it's a pleasure to be on with Roger and Matthias again. To answer your question directly, I think the data that's come out has been mixed, but more to the positive side, as Roger, you know, just spoke to. More jobs being added. You know, he gave you great data on going back to the Great Recession and the jobs, you know, that have been added. But when you get specific, you got to go sector by sector. So construction throughout the United States, especially the major cities, you're seeing a huge pickup in building: San Francisco, L.A., Boston, New York, and other major cities, and even some outliers like Seattle and Denver. So I think that's a sector doing well. Housing, you know, maybe not as well, but I think that's coming back as well. The other thing that sort of moves this a little bit, I think, are the markets. And after a, you know, a pretty shaky January and a pretty shaky third quarter last year, you know, companies get cautious and CapEx may slow. And slowing CapEx, not only in equipment, will lead to maybe slower job growth and possibly wages. But I think that's turning. And so when you look back to the Great Recession and the Fed's move, which came first, was QE, bringing rates down to a point now where the consumer can borrow at unbelievably good rates. It's been an amazing boom for real estate. And I think things are looking up. Between 1990 and 2010, they say there was 9 million jobs lost in the manufacturing sector in the United States. What people don't talk about is almost 4.5 million jobs were added in the tech space. So this whole movement of skilled workers moving from one sector to another, I think, is starting to play out. That's the reason I remain optimistic on the markets. I think technology is going to drive this thing going forward, and we're seeing it in various places around the country. Read about a big semiconductor plant being built in Ohio that used to house tire manufacturers, and 3,000 people were hired. So, you know, people on the negative will talk about robotics, but there's also 3,000 new people working in this plant. So I'm a big believer in the tech as the main driver for job creation and wage growth going forward.
Well, we're going to follow up this discussion by looking beyond the job market and wage growth at the economy and the consumer strength when we have the three of you back next week. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me on Money Life. This has been outstanding. You've been listening to Collective Wisdom from Hightower's Global Investment Solutions. HightowerAdvisors.com, on Twitter at Hightower, ADVSOR. My guests have been Matthias Coulme, Head of Global Investment Solutions at Hightower, Roger Schaefer of Schaefer Wealth Management in Alpharetta, Georgia, and Jimmy Hausberg of the Hausberg Group in Los Angeles. Follow Matthias on Twitter. He's at MoneyClipBlog. Up next, it's the Money Life Market Call, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Independent and advisor-owned,
Hightower ensures that best-in-class financial product and service providers compete for your business every day, a groundbreaking model that's making waves on Wall Street. Discover what Hightower can do for you at HightowerAdvisors.com.
It's hard to know what to do next in the stock market.
Where am I? What am I doing here?
That's because one expert's rally is another's prelude to a correction.
Of course, people do go both ways.
One manager's buy is another man's sell.
Have you come to any conclusions yet?
Each day, the Money Life Market Call brings you a different expert's take on where to invest and what to avoid.
Now listen, Grapehead, I'll explain it so even you can understand it.
Just as important, you'll find out the reasons behind that thinking, and that should make your next financial decisions easier and smarter.
We do have a system, and it works.
It's the Money Life Market Call. Now.
The only reason we're here is to make catty observations and rude remarks. And there was nothing good on TV.
It's Money Life Market Call time, and I'm joined right now by Peter Jacobs, President and Chief Investment Officer at Jacobs Broll Asset Management. If you are not familiar with the firm and you want to acquaint yourself, Jacobs-Broll, that's B-R-O-E-L, Jacobs-Broll.com. It's been a while. Peter Jacobs, welcome back to Money Life.
Thanks, Chuck. Glad to be back.
Now, you are a value investor, but value means lots of things to lots of people. So explain what it means to you so that we can understand how it is that you decide what to buy and what to avoid.
Well, our investment philosophy is deeply rooted in the value contrarian methodology, meaning that we're looking for companies that are out of favor, usually disliked by the general investment population. And we try to look past the current issues, what was happening this quarter or next quarter, and focus on what the intrinsic value is long term. And we're willing to buy into weakness. So that kind of differentiates ourselves as well, that we're willing to start buying and understanding that the value of that security may decline before it is fully recognized for the value that it does have down the road. And so we try to maintain focus on purchase price sensitivity, willing to buy into weakness. We also focus on our price objectives of what we believe is the intrinsic value and try to adhere to that. And so we're not drinking the lemonade when things start to work out very well and it gets fully priced in. We're agnostic to sectors, to geographic locations. We're just looking for a portfolio of 20 to 30 stocks that we know each of those well, and we're able to do the requisite handholding with our clients during that investment process to make it much smoother and easier emotionally for an investor, because they know what they own, they know why they own it, and they know what we're looking for in any given security.
What's your typical holding period and what makes you sell something?
Well, the ideal holding period is 366 days and with the stock working out perfectly. But that, kidding aside, our investment holding period is typically somewhere between 1 and 3 years, because to do what we do, we have to look out past the near-term focus and or the issues that a company is having. And that typically is at least 1 year. And many times it can take up to 3 years for an investment thesis to fully play out for us. And so we're prepared for that. But, you know, ideally it's 1 to 2 years.
When you get to that 1 to 2 years, if the stock is still at a spot where it's a good value play, I assume you're hanging on to it. What makes you sell? Is it that, hey, we've now gone from value to where the stock is morphing and becoming a growth company? We'll let somebody else ride that phase? Or what about when a stock looks like a value but feels more like a value trap? How do you decide then?
Well, we do review our securities. If they decline more than 25% from the initial purchase price, we do a thorough review to make sure that the investment thesis still holds up. And many times, if it has, we buy more. But there are occasions that that's just not the situation. And a good example of that was American Express. We started buying at $85 a share, and as that declined to 60, we decided to sell it because the investment thesis had changed. The Costco business that they're losing has more of an effect on their business. They're also seeing increased competition. So that's an example that we let go of a company. But most times we are buying into weakness and taking advantage of that. An example would be Perigo that we're buying currently. We started buying that about $130. And more recently, the CEO left.
They disclosed more difficulties in some of their businesses, and the stock's at 100. So we're off 30% there. But we're using that as an opportunity, as we think that there's real value in that. They're the leader in private label and store-branded over-the-counter drugs. They have a 65% market share. They have a branded OTC business in Europe, which we think has value. They also have a good generic pharmaceutical business as well. So the whole company is being valued at less than 12 times lowered earnings expectations, which are still going to have growth of some 10% this year. And we think long-term growth is still around 10%. So yeah, things got reset lower, but the intrinsic value of this company, we believe, is somewhere between $140 and $160 per share, and it's trading at 100. So there's two different sets of companies, one that we let go of and one that we're using the decline as an opportunity. One other good example that I like to point out is more recent. We started buying Mattel in the mid-20s early last year. It's currently at 32. That stock fluctuated. It got up to 28, went down to 20. So we had opportunities to get an average price of around $25 a share. It's now at 32. Our view of intrinsic value is 36. So there's one that we had exercised over a year of patience, and it's just more recently really started to perform for our accounts. But in the meantime, we were getting almost a 5% dividend, which we believed was secure. So it provided us income, I think support for the stock in the low 20s, and now we're on our way. So we're just holding tight with Mattel at this point. But that's a stock that's a good example of what we do and how we do it.
Well, in Mattel, a stock, in the old days, I would have had to disclose. I don't have to disclose it now, not because I've never owned it, but my kids. It was in my kids' portfolio. They've been waiting a long time for it to pay off. It was funny. One of my daughters looked at me and said, "What about Mattel?" And I said, "Now would not be the time." And you just confirmed that for her as she's looking at what she might do with some of that money at some point. When you talk about value right now in the market, we're seeing a market that got repriced a little bit with the horrible opening at the beginning of the year, and now it's been on a good run up. How are you finding valuations? I mean, are valuations reasonable right now on the whole, or is it very spotty? It's a buy here and a buy there, but really not a good trend in general.
Well, the number of stocks that we are currently buying is few and far between right now, but I will give you two examples of stocks that I do believe are buyable. But you're right. The market's up about 2% right now for the year after incurring some 10%+ decline through February. So we've recovered now. How the percentages works, we have now recovered some 15% from the lows. So that's pretty significant. I think the stock market is fairly valued here. It's trading at 17 times earnings, and you know, earnings for 2014, 15, and now 16, S&P earnings have basically been in the range of $118 to $120 per share. So it's basically we've had no earnings growth in the S&P. This is going to be the third year that's the case. And so, you know, the valuation's pretty fair in light, you know, even in light of the low interest rate environment. Now, two stocks that I do find value here at current levels are Wolverine Worldwide. That's WWW. That stock's right around $19 a share, from 35 from early 2015. They're the maker of Wolverine Shoes, Sperry, Topsiders, Hush Puppies, Sabago, Merrell, Saucony, one of the leading running shoes out there, Keds, and Stride-Rite. So it's a good company with good brands that is suffering from a difficult retail environment. But like I said, with a stock down from 35 to 19, now trading at less than 14 times earnings, I see value there. Another stock that we like is Nordstrom. JWN. That stock is down from $83 to currently right around $53. They also were facing some challenging retail environment, but they have a differentiated business model. They offer a customer a very high level experience, but they're also doing the right things in e-commerce with Nordstrom.com, with TheRack.com, with Hot Look, and they have a big opportunity to grow in Canada. In just a couple years, they should derive 30% of their revenue from the e-commerce channel. So Nordstrom and Wolverine Worldwide, we're buying in tandem. So we're basically buying a half of a position of each of those and kind of thinking about it as one position. with the idea that if either of these stocks weakens materially from current levels, we're going to be buying more of that individual stock. So there's two stocks that I throw out there as nice stocks to be buying at current levels.
Well, now that we have those as examples, let's find out how you feel about some stocks that my audience is particularly interested in.
Play, hold it.
You got to know when to hold up.
Or fold it.
Know when to fold up.
It's Hold It or Fold It time with my guest, Peter Jacobs, the president and chief investment officer at Jacobs Broll Asset Management. If you want more information, jacobs-broll.com. It's all linked up at the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page. Hold It or Fold It is easy. If you want to play yourself, you need to send us your name, your hometown, and the ticker symbols you're interested in for stocks, mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, closed-end funds. You need to send that to chuck@moneylifeshow.com. We're going to start with a request that we got from Mike in Redwood City, California, Rich in Orchard Beach, Maryland, and Rick in York, Pennsylvania. They all wanted to know about Realty Income. That's ticker symbol O.
Yes, Realty Income. I would hold that. They're one of the largest office and commercial property REITs out there. Their customers include FedEx, Dollar General, Walgreens. A 4% dividend yield, and you're looking at a rising income stream and a good environment for business and commercial properties. So hold that one.
Would you be buying more at this point? I mean, we call it hold it or fold it, but we can actually give buy recommendations. Everything you said there sounded good enough. Is it priced right to be a buy, or is it priced to be a hold for you?
It's a hold right now just because of the recent relative strength. We've seen this stock move from, you know, 45-ish, $50-ish levels late last year, early this year, to closer to 60 currently. So I'm just reluctant always to buy into near-term relative strength.
Okay.
But I like it for the income stream.
So that is a hold on Realty Income, ticker symbol O. Next up. Again, for Rick in York, Pennsylvania, this time sharing it with Dave in Vestal, New York, it's Norfolk Southern Corp, NSC.
I would fold Norfolk Southern. And the reason is I like the rails in general, the railroads, but I would rather be buying CSX Corp. I think that's just cheaper on a multiple basis, and it has more room for improvement. If there's a high switching cost involved in, you know, switching out of Norfolk into CSX, well, then maybe just stay with Norfolk, because I do like the rails in general. I just have and think that there are better opportunities with the CSX than the Norfolk.
That was a fold on Norfolk Southern, NSC, but hidden in there was a buy, or not so hidden, you actually said it directly, was a buy on CSX, ticker symbol CSX. Next, for Dave in Beaver Dams, New York, it's Pfizer PFE, and before I say anything more, I need to disclose that that happens to be a stock in my own portfolio.
And Chuck, I got to disclose that that is a stock in our portfolio as well. And we are holding that stock. We believe the intrinsic value is $40. And for somebody that is looking to get pharmaceutical exposure, providing a nice 3% dividend yield and 13 times earnings, I think that is viable. Preferably, I'd be buying it under 30, but you know, 32, 33, that's okay. I think it still has nice upside.
Okay. So we have the buy side there. And actually, you know what? I didn't need to disclose that at all. I totally whiffed on the fact I actually sold my Pfizer shares because I'd said I wouldn't own anybody who went through an inversion. And they had agreed to one. Of course, that has now been done. But I actually took my profits on Pfizer because of my stand on inversions. Wow. It's rare when I lose track of my portfolio. I did there. But that was a hold, looking for that better price, sort of hold towards a buy on Pfizer, PFE. Dale in London, Ohio, wants to know about Intel, INTC.
I like Intel here. I would be holding it and perhaps even buying it if you're looking to add to your technology holdings. That is a holding in our portfolios. I just want to disclose that. But this stock, they're finally making proactive moves to get past the headwinds created by their processor exposure to the PC market. And I think that's going to provide some good earnings growth then as we look out into 2017 and 18. But right now at 13 times earnings, a 3.3% dividend yield, I'd be holding Intel because better times are not too far away for this company. And it's a cheap stock anyways on current year earnings.
Okay, so hold it if you've got it and you're looking at buying more on Intel, a hold to a buy on INTC. And last, for Joe in Colorado Springs, it's Nabors Industries Limited. That's NBR.
Nabors, I would fold that. And the reason is they have a high debt level. I think that they're a second-tier oil services company. I would prefer, if one wanted exposure to oil services companies, I'd be looking at either Helmerich & Payne, that's ticker HP, Baker Hughes, ticker BHI, or even Halliburton, H-A-L. We own none of those, but that if I was going to have something in that space, those would be my preferred plays other than Nabors.
But since you point out, okay, those would be your preferred plays, you hold none of them. Is that also in part because energy services, energy sector in general, you still see as a value trap?
No, actually, we have positions in ConocoPhillips and in Chevron. And those are, you know, an E&P company and an integrated oil company. So that's how we've approached our exposure in the energy space. But from an energy services company, an oil services company, I don't necessarily like Nabors. And if I were to have exposure in oil services, I'd rather have okay. one of those other three that I mentioned.
Right. So a fold, a sell on Nabors Industries, NBR, preference here. Helmerich & Payne, HP, Baker Hughes, BHI, or Halliburton, HAL. And in that, you also heard that Peter owns ConocoPhillips and Chevron, COP and CVX. Well, we have come to the end of our time, but Peter, this has been great. I hope we get a chance to do this with you again in the not-too-distant future.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I enjoyed it.
Peter Jacobs is the President and Chief Investment Officer at Jacobs Brohl Asset Management. For more information, jacobs-brohl.com. We're just about done with today's show, but just about means not quite. We'll clue you in on what Peter talked about that other guests have discussed recently and how those things jive before we end today's show right after this message.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors Incorporated.
That was fun. That was a lot of fun talking with Peter Jacobs. I thought that interview went very well, and we had some interesting... Now, the one thing that did not go well there was me having that little brain cramp I had about my own portfolio. Yeah, I disclosed that I own Pfizer when I don't own it anymore. I had promised I would get rid of it if they went through with the inversion, and then we got past the turn of the year. They were still planning on the inversion at that point. And so I did make the trade, although I know that one or two audience members pointed out to me that I didn't have to by the time they dropped me those notes when the deal was falling apart, I had already sold. So sorry to confuse you, a little extra disclosure, didn't hurt anybody. No, I don't own Pfizer. Now let's disclose a couple other things. You may have missed it, but of course, one of the stocks that you just heard Peter Jacobs talk about during Hold It or Fold It was Intel, which he gave a hold to a buy. That was really how he put it. He had it as a hold, almost ready to buy it, wants a better price. Okay, that's fine. We could all use a better price. Well, that stock was last discussed on this show yesterday. That's right. Barry James talked about it yesterday. He had it as a buy. And you might recall, I said at the end of the show, Ian Mortimer had talked about it from Guinness Atkinson. He had it as a buy, and Bernie Horn had talked about it. He had it as a sell. So we've now had buy, sell, and hold, with the extra opinion being on the buy side. and one tells him, but difference of opinion, one day apart. Mm-hmm. It does happen here on this show. So that clears up that last little bit. We've got big things planned for you every day. Tomorrow on this show, Brian Peary, Charlie Bolello, Greg McBride, and more. So plan to be with us. We look forward to having you here. All right. I want to thank my guests from today. And of course, that means Peter Jacobs, Brian Singer, the Hightower Gang, Matthias Coulmé, and others. And of course, Tom Lydon. I want to thank Bob Powell, who, although he wasn't here, would have been here if we hadn't changed our schedule around this week. And it's always great that we have him. I want to thank Rob Floyd, my producer. I want to thank Bob Robertson, who was essential in helping me get this stuff done today. And I want to thank you. All right, it's time for the Money Life quote of the day. And today our quote comes from Warren Buffett, who said, "What counts for most people in investing is not how much they know, but rather how realistically they define what they don't know." Yeah, well, one thing we hope you know for sure is that until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The opinions expressed on Money Life are those of the host and guests only and reflect their personal thinking. They are not to be taken as representative policy or strategy of the organization that the host or guest represents. This show is a production of Money Life Radio, Inc., which retains all rights to its content. This broadcast, either in part or in its entirety, may not be retransmitted, reproduced, or rebroadcast without the express consent of Money Life Radio, Inc. This show is an informational service only. The information here is not to be considered a direct and personal recommendation for any individual to make a specific financial decision or transaction, but rather is meant as an informal resource to help investors make informed decisions. Always consult your financial advisor, accountant, or attorney before making any major financial decision. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed for either its accuracy or completeness.
We're back to happy days again.